Hello and welcome to Think Rant, the podcast that promises two things but usually only delivers one of them. I'm your host, John Staber, and this week I'm joined by my regular co-hosts, the first of which is our very own answer to Carl Pilkington. It's comedy genius, Stephen Brett.
Good evening.
And also with me is the deep rumbling voice of reason that is Trevor Williams.
Hello.
We thought we'd get a high caliber guest for this show. After a little deliberation, we decided on inviting perhaps one of the greatest evolutionary biologists that's ever lived, a towering figure in the world of science, scepticism, rationalism, and a major force in the new atheism movement. Unfortunately, Richard Dawkins was unavailable, so we've got Professor P.Z. Myers instead. Hello.
Hello. It's good to know I'm second best.
that's the only offensive thing I've got. I promise. All joking aside, we're really pleased you could be with us, PZ.
Oh, sure. It's easy.
I'm glad. I might actually, hound you more often. so you might want to take that back later. Trevor and I are big fans of your work. We're regularly checking out your blog, Pharyngula, or as Johan Hari pronounces it, Pharyngula. I'm losing all faith in that guy. I was going to ask him on, but I'm not going to bother. He's going to be like that.
Oh, no, come on. He got the Dalai Lama angry.
Yes. So. Yeah, he gets a big thumbs up from me in my book for that one.
Yeah, but, the kudos can only last so long. It's got to have sort of, diminishing returns. Anyway, we love the blog. And for those of the listeners that don't know who PZ is... why are you listening? I don't know who you are. But Professor P.Z. Myers is a biology lecturer at the University of Minnesota Morris. But I think you're more well known perhaps on the internet for what I call shenanigans. Crackergate being one of them. And Expelled from Expelled being another. I don't know if you necessarily want to talk about them because I know you're probably... bored of that. We'll see how we do for time. But the first question I wanted to ask was, you post so frequently on your blog. I mean, some days, you're looking five posts, all of them, we're not just talking a couple of lines. You give back a lot to the community. You do a lot of debating. You do a lot of podcasts, things like that. And I was just wondering how you fit that in with, obviously with your university work.
People are always asking me that, it's not hard, it's not unusual. What it is that everyone else is so damn lazy. So step it up a little bit, guys. Get to work. Come on.
Well,
damn. See, that hurts because we know we're lazy as well.
Yeah,
maybe one podcast a week,
Yeah.
Oh, pathetic. Do it every day.
We're going to have to be careful we don't make this episode too high in quality. We don't want to mislead any new listeners as to the nature of our back catalogue. Okay.
There's nothing wrong with our back catalogue. There's been some great episodes. Nothing springs to mind, but there were some great episodes.
They felt good at the time. Low expectations are your friend.
Yeah, quite. Okay, Trev, I understand that you've got quite a few questions for PZ, so maybe you should lead the way on this one.
Sure. Okay, well, there's a couple of things. Ideas to discuss. We were originally, I wanted to get in touch with you for the brilliant response to when the rapture didn't happen, and everybody crawled out of the woodwork saying, but Jesus said that we wouldn't know. And you're brilliant. Profane response to that. I don't fucking care what fucking Jesus fucking said. which is just fantastic. In fact, anybody who's listening who isn't entirely sure about that should just pause now and go and Google it. Are you back? You're welcome.
Uh-huh. And if they're offended, they should leave right now.
It's only going to get worse.
Yeah, it's not going to get much better. I'm fairly sure that you will know all about the new university proposed by A.C. Grayling.
Yes.
Because, in this country, it seems like private universities are inevitable. Everything does seem to be kind of falling apart with the public institution. And it, it seems to me that Grayling's hoping to lead like this next wave of British learning in a direction that's going to ensure every graduate has critical thinking skills, and that the often derided but valuable humanities subjects aren't lost, that this new wave of higher education doesn't wash away things we'll never be able to afford to replace. And I see that if a bunch of right-wing mental cases, like some opulent economic political think tanks, if they made a move like this, I don't think they'd get the criticism. It's because they're reasonable, friendly, liberal-sounding professors, and that they're making a profit. And everybody seems to be attacking the wrong thing.
Well, yeah, you know, this is really an awkward topic for me, because here I am, I'm in the United States, and what he's doing is kind of the default out here, that we've got state universities in every state that are supported by state funds, but then all the other universities typically are, you know, there's a scattering of private universities, and there's community colleges, all these different levels of education. And those are run often on a model that's described by Grayling. So when I heard, you know, when I first heard this described, his what he was planning to do, I said, "Well, okay, so what? That's what everybody does, isn't it?" But then, yeah, I understand now the problem that it's having in the UK, and that is that you are used to, you have an expectation that the government will step in and provide decent education for all people. And we do not have that expectation in the United States. And in a sense, I can understand why people are upset, because what Grayling is sort of doing is throwing up his hands and saying, okay, we give up. We're not getting the support we need. We've got to find other avenues. And that giving up is what's got people upset. On the other hand, you know, I really admire what he's doing. That the other phenomenon we see going on in the United States a lot is we're going to more and more of these awful pseudo universities where they're basically teaching you a trade. They're glorified trade schools that give out academic degrees, and I'll get some enemies by saying this, but I think the MBA is a disaster. The fact that we've got business schools dominating much of the revenue of universities, well, that's overstating it, but that are making such a big part of our universities is disastrous. It's a horrible thing that's happened. And Grayling, I think, reasonably enough, wants to go back to the great tradition of a broad-based liberal education. And I love that idea. That's what my university is like. That's what... I'm at a small private liberal or public liberal arts college here in the United States, and that's their mission, is to make sure that all of our students come out of here well-rounded with a broad education.
Yeah, I worry that if Grayling waits to make sure that the fight is actually lost and that there's no hope, then it'll be too late to lead the charge. And if he makes it a success of it now and makes it profitable so that other private universities will want to follow the curriculum, then we end up with a whole generation of people with critical thinking skills, which would just be wonderful. Fewer dumb people.
Okay, now you're going to make me argue with you.
Okay, great.
Because my problem is that profitable business. That I don't really want it to be profitable. I want it to be, you know, I want it to be an institution with high ideals that needs the government to step in and rescue it. If it's profitable, what that means is that a lot of rich gits out there in the United Kingdom are taking advantage of it, and that's not fair. There is smart middle class and lower class people who need the opportunity as well, and I hope that they have a mechanism where they can give opportunities to many other people. In the United States, for instance, in the private schools, what they will do is they will have large endowments. And I'd be surprised if Grayling School has a large endowment. And with that large endowment, what they can do is they can offer substantial scholarships, you know, need-based scholarships. So, for instance, I mentioned I'm at a public liberal arts university. It's funded by the state, so we've got a cheap tuition. There are private schools that we compete with that when you just look at them on paper, you look at their tuition fees, they're exorbitant. They're way out there. But what will happen is that when a poor student applies, they will give them substantial scholarships to make it up so that they actually are competitive with us. Now, the question is whether Grayling's university could do that, and I don't know.
I mean, I know that there is going to be some, there's going to be some kind of a fund set up to allow people from poorer backgrounds, as they call it, to attend.
I don't know, the impression I had, because I completely agree with PC there, what you had to say with the regards to education, the sort of two-tier system where people can afford to go and people can't afford to go, and, you know, the quality of education in that. And I don't know, I kind of, from what I've read about Grayling's idea, is it's, yes, it's a profitable institution, but it's a bit more philanthropic than that as well. It's about sharing these liberal arts ideas, which I think is fantastic, because what I really see this as is a response to all the government rhetoric that we've had in the UK recently, where, you know, we're being told that these subjects aren't of value by the government. You know, the sciences and scientific study and, you know, such things, they're valuable, but philosophy, that's not a valuable subject to be studying. You know, it doesn't have any use in the wider world, then. It's kind of the argument that we're getting from the government all the time, and I see what Grayling is doing is a response to that.
Right. And I fully agree with that. I'm at a university where I teach science. And okay, my university is fairly well known for a good, solid science program. But I think it's bad if you go to a school and just sit there and do science classes all day long. We force our students, we compel them by telling them that you will not graduate unless you meet the distribution requirement. And that means going out and taking a foreign language and taking literature and, you know, doing social studies and anthropology and all this, and art, all these things that I think are essential for a well-rounded student.
I'd like to make sure that I get across the point that I don't think that profitability is a great thing. I think it's what's going to lead the universities that follow. I can't even aspire to be working class. I'm benefit class, which is totally sneered at in this country. And but I study philosophy, and I notice as well, Brian Cox is a bit of a science hero in this country at the moment, but him and a couple of people like him have got a sort of disapproval of philosophy and these type of subjects. And that's fine if you've got a good grasp of the philosophy of science, but there's plenty of scientists who don't.
Yeah.
You know, and then they fall prey to logical error, whether intentionally or not. They allow their arguments to fall to logical abuse. And
may I interject here with a question for PZ, because you've kind of tripped over onto something I wanted to ask him about, which was Stephen Hawking, in his book The Grand Design, decided to announce that philosophy was dead, and he's kind of made the same statements in ambiguous terms in recent talks. And I was just thinking, I just wanted to know, PZ, what do you think is the future of philosophy and science?
Oh, I disagree with Hawking on that entirely. He's right that religion is dead, but not philosophy. Philosophy is something different. Now, the model in my head, the little rubric I apply to everything is philosophy is good for helping you ask good questions, and science is what makes you able to answer those questions. And so by throwing out philosophy, I think you throw out a lot of the value of that important step of asking good questions about something. So, no, I would like my students to get more philosophy.
Oh, great. Are we going to actually disagree on anything in this podcast?
I don't know. We'll work on it. We'll get there eventually. Yeah.
And also, just staying with the universities, just briefly, they've announced now that they want to bring competition into universities. Sure. Now, which obviously would involve privatization and bringing companies in, so it's all about profit again. Displeasure at some of the funding sources that are around, for instance, the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
How do you think this is going to play out? Do you think it's just all bad news?
It's all bad news. I mean, can you imagine privatizing kindergarten? Can you imagine telling people, "Well, we're gonna turn, you know, those 5-year olds into a profit making enterprise and see what we can do there"? That's a complete abdication of the ideal of the educated democratic society. That I think that a basic education ought to be a fundamental right, and it's not something that you put up for bid. It's not something that you turn over to industry and tell them, "Well, fund what you need because industry tends to be really short-sighted and stupid. And I think it's terrible. I would like to see public universities everywhere. And again, going back to Grayling, like, that's why I say I can understand the gripes with him, the unhappiness with this, is because that is the ideal we ought to be pursuing. There's always this trade-off with, you know, practical concerns, and face it, and education is actually expensive. But what Grayling is asking people to pay for his university is not out of line for the actual costs of a university education.
Yeah, I think we all agreed that basically Grayling's university isn't the problem. It's just a symptom of what is the problem.
Absolutely.
I remember, was it Vince Cable, maybe about a year ago, was saying about when we restructure all of our education, we want to put lots of money into the useful sciences that bring about discovery, which was astonishing because he's obviously a better scientist than anybody working at the moment, because how on earth do you predict where a discovery is going to come unless it's already been discovered?
Yeah, I mean, we do need kind of a two-tiered system, I think. You know, we do need something where we say, okay, we're going to have an educational system that supports those so-called useful, you know, skills, the equivalent of the technical trade school. And that's great for some people. I think MDs, doctors, ought to go through that kind of training. But there should also be another tier that says, okay, here's stuff that we don't have an immediate use for, but it's smart stuff and it's interesting stuff and it's going to lead into new discoveries in the future. And we treat that as something a little different. And that, of course, needs the support of the government because it's not going to get endorsed by industry. I got my training, for instance, in neuroscience. And neuroscience is great for the future. It's really interesting stuff. There's all kinds of cool stuff emerging out about it. But what you find when you talk to people is they all think, oh, well, you're a brain surgeon. And we're not, okay? We have nothing to do with those people. Those people are peons. They don't know a thing. And you know, they're good practical plumbers of the brain. That's what they're good at. They're making things work. And it's a valuable skill, but it's not the kind of esoteric source of new knowledge that you need if you're going to make advances.
It's more like a lumberjack than anything else.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, I used to get all these comments from people about, they thought, oh, neuroscientists, neurosurgeons, they've got such great hands, they do such amazing things. And I've worked with real neurosurgeons, and it's like they're slicing up sponges with butcher knives. You know, they're crude. The kinds of work I did was all single cell work. So, you know, you're using micro manipulators, and you're getting there with these tiny little needles, and you're doing these very delicate jobs. Finessing individual cells and so forth. Neurosurgeons are butchers compared to that. They don't do anything like that.
As much as I'd love to agree with you and encourage this discussion, I've had brain surgery and might need it again in the future. So why don't we just change the subject just in case someone's listening?
Don't piss off your doctors, right?
It's kind of like people in the cafeteria. You don't want to upset them, otherwise they'll spit in your food. So.
Exactly.
Some of the most important people in the hospital.
Yes. Well, but this is the difference, that what you're concerned about is a very applied use of knowledge of the brain. That you want somebody to go in and just make your brain work better, or to prevent this little problem that keeps recurring. You're not interested in having somebody go in and puzzle out exactly what you think about your girlfriend when you're thinking about her. You want something a little bit coarser, a little bit cruder, but just as essential. And a neuroscientist is going to be more interested in what kinds of activities are going on inside the brain to generate thoughts, for instance. How are memories stored? How does neuroplasticity affect changes in brain function over time?
Yeah, in fact, I probably regret asking this, but we had a debate about free will. And I'm convinced that you can still say that human beings have free will, because when a neuroscientist points at flashing lights on a brain scan, it doesn't necessarily mean that the meat inside has generated it. And it seemed to go quite well for me against John on that proposition.
Well, it was,
but that
it was
just the one night, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it, what happened was the person I asked to be a judge was he's a bit of a simpleton. So
it wasn't me, by the way.
Yeah. Sorry, Rob, if you're listening. But I think... Sorry, I'm just a bit of a reductionist. That's what you might call me. But I'm sure PZ will agree that free will is a terrible illusion.
Yes, I do. It's... you know, there have been all these interesting studies now that are showing that people make decisions before they're conscious of them, you know, like fractions of a second to a few seconds before they actually are aware of the fact they made a decision to go this way or that way. And in a sense, that doesn't really undermine free will. It just means that that there's a multi-layered brain, a multi-layered mind, and that the parts that are making these decisions are just deeper parts that you're not always aware of. But ultimately, it's still going to be, you know, physical chemical processes. It's going to be that kind of stuff going on. It's not your self is not a separate entity floating above your brain making decisions independent of all of its past. No, it's entirely contingent on what you've experienced in the past, and that's just fine. There's no free will, but so what? We have a nice illusion of it, and also. You know, operationally, it's still kind of free will because it doesn't matter. You cannot predict what somebody will do moment by moment, except on a fairly coarse level.
Trev, John's doing a little victory dance here.
No, I'm very gracious. Yeah, but I joke. I mean, I'm sure PZ isn't the final arbiter of all arguments.
Wait, just this one.
What? But you are tonight, so thanks.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Trev, you can continue now.
Yeah, there was an article on the Guardian website just a day or two ago about when science is hidden behind a smokescreen. It said Robert Proctor of Stanford University coined the term agnotology in 1992, and in recent years, agnotology has been extended to cover a discipline at the junction of philosophy, sociology, and the history of science, its purpose being the study of ignorance itself, and the means employed to generate, sustain, and broadcast it. In the UK, that's called the Daily Mail, and you have the Fox News Network.
Right, yes.
But yeah, it's apparently become a field of study now, which hopefully... will be informative to everybody. Part of it is about the creationists and the teach the controversy being a total disguise.
Yeah, yes, PZ, you just ripped those DVDs of the Bergman debate. I mean, that's right. A lot of source material for this ignorant study, surely.
Yes. Oh, yes. I hadn't heard of this before, but I'm kind of impressed because, boy, there's limitless fields there, isn't there? Job security for life if you get into that.
Yeah.
I want tenure. Yeah.
I'm just wondering who's paying for it, though.
Always the Stanford cynic. University.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it has a go at the American tobacco industry quite badly.
Oh,
so not
right.
Them.
Yes, they are a group that has actively promoted ignorance for many years. I would think the government would be a prime field of study as well. You know, we here in the United States, we're paying for these wars overseas, and we keep being told we've won, we're winning. You know, we've accomplished everything, and yet we keep on fighting. And so somehow there's some kind of ignorance being promoted there too.
Not from the government, surely. I can't believe that for a minute.
You're so naive, Steve. You know? Yeah, unfortunately, you look at our government and we're pretty upset with the way things are at the moment. But then we just have to go and check out some US news and you kind of feel a lot better.
I'm sure you do, yeah. So what's our excuse? I've been kind of distressed at the level of apathy among college students these last couple of years. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s where we'd go out every night and riot and protest and march around with signs, and nobody's doing that anymore.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, so, we felt the same way over
I think
the alternative
vote. Because, you know, people having to pay large amounts of tuition fees and, you know, too busy studying or something.
They can't afford to go and buy the wood to make a torch.
Exactly,
to,
yeah.
Go out on the streets
oh.
with.
Yeah.
No, I go down to the... I can go down to the bar on Thursday night when they have the dollar cats or whatever it is. And I see what the students are doing. And they're not making signs.
No, I would anyway, you know.
I don't know how you see... The British, as an American observer, but I think that we could be the most apathetic country on earth. And we're hosting the Olympics next year, but if apathy were an event, well, we would withdraw uh-huh. from it because we don't want to risk winning anything.
It would be like Phelps in swimming, with a you know.
Yeah. Although you know, when I was in London a few weeks ago and gave a talk with Richard Dawkins, we got a little protest going there that disrupted the whole event for about 20 minutes or so at the beginning.
So, oh yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of rooting for them, but
but you bumped into some Muslims as well, didn't you, when you were out and about in
the
UK?
Oh yes. Yeah, that's another difference between the United States and UK is you know, we don't have as much of a Muslim presence here. There's some here in Minnesota, for instance, we have a large Somali population in Minneapolis, but that's about it. And they're not active the way these Muslim creationists are. They mainly want to be left alone.
Yeah, I think since September 11th, maybe a lot of them are probably keeping a low profile because, you know, there's still a bit of a mood towards them. In the US,
mm-hmm.
whereas in this country, they've been integrating for a
lot
longer.
But again, I think that's partly down to the way people are portrayed in the media as well, isn't it? You know, in the media, I mean, obviously, PZ, you live in America, you've seen it, but for me, if I watch Fox News, it's very clear that Muslims are the enemy. You know, and... I don't know, but, you know, I think that'll probably have something to do with Muslims maybe feeling a bit that they have people underground. In the States
right.
than they do in the UK, I guess.
Yes, of course, you know, I get a slightly different perspective of them because, you know, you watch Fox News, which I avoid as much as possible, and, yeah. you know, you see the stuff from the Middle East with them standing around with torches and rioting and screaming and yet waving signs, and all the Muslims I've met here in the United States are dressed in casual wear or suits or whatever, and they're educated and intelligent. They're in my classes talking to me, and... There's a real disjunct between those two images, and the most of the Muslims I've met in the United States have been educated, middle class and upper class people who are, you know, here by choice, except for a few that segregate themselves off in little neighborhoods.
Well, when I heard you earlier, you said about you were hoping that education should always be a concern of the government. So it does sound like you don't mind lost causes.
Right.
So one of the things...
I'm socialist leaning and I live in America. You know, so there's... there we are.
Just waiting for the next wave of McCarthyism to sweep you out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we're so apathetic here and there's no constitution. You at least have always got that document to stop the state from supporting religion, or you can at least point to it. But over here, I mean, the religious say that Britain is 90% religious, and uncritical atheists say Britain is 90% atheist, and they're all uh-huh. quoting the same study, because it's 10% right. one way, 10% the other, and 80% couldn't care less.
Yes,
and that's the true apathy, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a kind of nominal religiosity that a lot of people have, where they're willing to say, well, yeah, I was baptized Catholic or Anglican or Lutheran or whatever, and so I sort of identified with that religion, but you know, I never go to church, and so that can go either way. You can either count them as members of their particular faith that they were born into, or you count them as they're not believers, and it's kind of silly, kind of a pointless argument there. The real truth is, all the sensible, rational people are atheists, and the other ones are just crazy.
Oh, I do like that.
Oh, there you go, Steve. So yeah, yeah, that's
I'll
well
get
done,
my
PC.
Tin hat now.
Yeah, yeah, you've upset the token Christian. Nice.
Oh, oh well. I'll
not at all, PZ. You carry on. It's like, fine. I got broader shoulders than that. It's
yeah,
okay.
Hey, PZ, were you about to feign like you cared for a second?
No, I was sitting there trying to think of, well, how else can I insult this guy now?
Unfortunately, he's not a Catholic, so you can keep your cracker in the bin, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's one of those. He's one of those waffly sorts. Then, all right.
Yeah, yeah. I do waffle yeah. quite a bit, really. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Bit. You know, go with the breeze. You know,
like any good Anglican, you don't like to talk about it.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well. Grow up somebody. That's all I can say.
I'll take that on board. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it seems like he promises to think about it.
When the religious get their figures together, it seems they ask the question, are you religious? No. So you want to ban Christmas then? And then they manage to get a whole bunch of people to join on.
Yeah.
Like they're not afraid of the slippery slope argument. They know
it's
disingenuous.
Right.
But what
they embrace it. Yeah, it's great for them. They love it. And then, you know, you've got people like me and Richard Dawkins who celebrate Christmas every year. Yeah, we put up a tree. You know, I decorate it with squid, but it's still a Christmas tree.
Doesn't that get a bit stinky, though, by, you know, the 12 night?
Oh, come on, these are fake squid. No, I wouldn't sacrifice a real squid.
That'd be quite inhumane, surely. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to do a Catholic story. Have you got a jingle for me?
Here we go. Okay. So, PZ, we have this regular feature every week now. So, I'm just if you can just bear with us for a couple of minutes while I introduce it.
Okay.
Does Trevor have a Catholic story this week? Well, do you?
No. Yeah, I do.
Okay. I'm in a properly reverential mood now. So yes, fairly.
Excellent. The same-sex marriage approval undermines families, New York bishops say.
Gotta love them.
Let's see. What... I'll get down this.
Love the gays, hate the sin.
Oh, cool. Let's see, more than half of all New Yorkers oppose this legislation, said a bishop, quoting God knows what. Yet the governor and the state legislature have demonized people of faith, whether they be Muslims, Jews, or Christians, on the same side all of a sudden, and identified them as bigots and prejudice. A last-minute amendment to the legislation exempts any clergy members who decline to perform same-sex weddings and protects any employee. He said the amendment showed that our political leaders do not believe their own rhetoric. What does he want? He clearly needs that amendment, and he would have bitched if he hadn't got it. He goes on to say, if they did believe their own rhetoric, how in good conscience could they carve out any exemption for institutions that would be proponents of bigotry and prejudice?
Interesting.
He said that, basically saying, I want to carry on being bigoted and prejudiced without being called on it or exempted because of it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is familiar rhetoric from the Catholic Church, right? Okay.
Like there's nobody standing next to him saying, do you know what you just said?
You know, sometimes you do wish that, remember in like the cartoons where they have the angel and the demon over the shoulders? I just think they just need one of them on the shoulder of a bishop just to remind him, you know, you can call it a dictaphone or something, you know, just something to remind him of what he said and how much of a fool he looks.
Uh-huh.
It's insane, isn't it? You know, I can't believe they, again, we're all in agreement, aren't we? Just...
Yeah, come on.
Completely
idiotic, find something we're going to disagree about, Trev.
Okay, Green Lantern.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
The Catholic Review of Green Lantern says it's for adults only because scenes in which Hal Jordan creates physical objects by willing them into existence, a form of creativity reserved to God alone, as well as a script that presents the will properly channeled as the strongest force in the universe, suggest a worldview not easily squared with the teachings of Scripture. So there you go.
It's quite unbelievable what makes a Catholic uneasy these days, really.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know, sorry, what was website, Trev, that you sent to me? It's the Catholic review of all these films, and basically you can't watch anything.
Yeah, the Catholic News Service, it has a little page reviewing films and basically saying if there's anything even remotely iffy.
All right. So why don't we just have a new rating system when we get there? No Catholics allowed in this movie.
Or they just have Lady Gaga at the front of the cinema.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Just tell them all it's a Kevin Smith film. They'll never go anyway. Well, they'll protest outside, but they won't go and watch it.
Well, these days, something being an R or an 18, it doesn't really guarantee anything dreadful, does it? If you really want to see a horrible horror, you're going to see what the Catholics think about it. If you want some proper sex and violence and some horrific scenes, that's the place to look.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, yeah, okay. Although I'm thinking The Passion of the Christ.
Yeah,
that was hardly approved of by the Catholics, yet at the same time, that was the most awful torture flick I've ever seen. It's nonstop ripping somebody to death and having them bleed all over the place, and that's all the movie was about.
Was that not a prequel to Saw? A prequel by about 2,000 years, but...
Yeah.
So you gotta ask your question. You know, what did Jesus do to deserve, you know, that, you know, the punishment? Because in Saw, I mean, those people did some pretty rubbish things.
Oh, Jesus's great crime was not existing.
You don't exist. So we're going to check you on this tree, and then every 5 minutes, a Roman soldier is going to come up to you and say, "Hey, Jesus, how's it hanging?"
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to get the house
hanging. A billion people who believe in this guy, he never existed, so it's a great crime.
But we could get into a debate saying, well, there may have been a man called Jesus who lived there.
I think there's a man called Jesus living in Mexico right now. So what?
Yeah, 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 a guy called Dave living now. In 2,000 years, we're not going to see that he came back to life.
Yeah, yeah. In all fairness, there was probably quite a few Jesuses living in Israel at the time.
Yeah, it's quite a popular name back then, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yes. And just about every other Jew at that time was a fanatic for their religion. So, you know, that's another given right there. So, yeah, I'm sure there were lots of Jesuses around.
In fact, Jesus was just the old Muhammad. You know, Muhammad's just the new Jesus.
Uh-huh. Let's offend both big Abrahamic
faiths. Well, to be honest, I'm kind of jealous of you, PZ, because you've received death threats, and I haven't had any yet. I mean,
I thought you had an email this week.
No, I've had, well, I'll say his name once, but it's banned from the podcast. I've had Mabus send me a tweet, but, you know, we won't give him any more airtime. So
No, he sends me a few hundred every day.
Oh, my God.
Have you ever considered changing your email address?
Well, my email is actually pretty well filtered, but Twitter, you know, he gets a new account all the time, and so it's... But fortunately with Twitter, all you gotta do is when he creates a new account, you just go in there and you ban that account, and all of his tweets disappear. So it's actually kind of satisfying when I log into Twitter and I look up there and I see, you know, 200 things from David Mabus, and I click on one, it's like, make it go away, and I'll go zoop, and they're gone.
The wonders of modern technology.
Yes, all that work, and it just disappears in an instant. Oh.
It's not really work; it's more copy pasting, though, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's just. Yeah, that's all he does.
Bless the delete all button. Stops you getting repetitive strain injury in that finger. Clicking over and over again.
Quite.
I got a serious question at the moment. Listen to this. We're talking about the Bergman debate, which Trev and I listened to today, which it was a bit of a whitewash, as we say. But my question was actually, you know, you talk to all these creationists, you debate them, and a lot of them are obviously true believers. You know, they believe what they're preaching or what they're debating. you know, and they are just, you know, literally ignorant of the facts, perhaps. But do you think anybody has, you know, any of these creationists or ID proponents have exposed themselves for being willfully misleading or just making it up?
I mean, have they been exposed as genuine con artists?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, or yeah. Do you have your suspicions about anybody who's doing the rounds at the moment?
Oh, well, yeah. The thing is, though, that the problem with that definition, you know, the idea that you're a con artist is that you're scamming somebody for money, that you're trying to make a profit off of them. And these are people who are so dedicated to Jesus or Muhammad or whoever that their profit comes in trying to get converts. So they're con artists of a sort. They're all lying and misleading and teasing you along, but it's for the purpose of proselytizing. So it's unfortunate, the kind of thing you can't have them arrested for.
No, but I meant kind of, you know, academically, you know, is there been an instance where there's obviously evidence that they've, you know, really gone out of the way to misrepresent something, not just subconsciously, but purposely?
Oh, that's a tougher one. You know, I've caught several of them in misleading quotes. That recently, for instance, I wrote about this guy, Jonathan McClatchy, in Glasgow, who's part of the ID Center there, apparently. And he is always waving these science papers around it. And he's saying, okay, well, you got to read this one. This one shows that his ideas are right and that evolution is wrong and intelligent design is the answer. And every one of these papers is, you know, a conventional part of the scientific literature. And many of them are from people like Per Albrecht was one who cited at me recently, and who people who are well known for their defense of evolution, who are active evolutionary biologists. And that there's a dilemma there, because, you know, how can you read a paper by Rudy Raff or Per Albrecht or any of these other, or Sean Carroll, they've also cited him at me, and then somehow come away with the idea that this is a refutation of evolution, when all of these guys are active scientists working in the field who have openly embraced evolution, and here's all this evidence, here's my book just explaining all this evidence for evolution. And these guys look at it and they say, oh, this book disproves evolution. It's there's something wrong with their head. And I don't know that I could come out and say they're really trying to mislead or lie, that they've got no other, that they're consciously manipulating the evidence. It's actually a difficult situation because we don't have good words for this.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
They're so good, you know, committed.
Yes. And so, you know, I often get this argument, well, you just, you know, people tell me, well, you just said that this creationist is lying to us, but, you know, I don't believe he's smart enough to know that he's lying. And lying ought to imply intent. And, you know, I guess, okay, sure, but then maybe lying is the wrong word. But the word we need is a stronger word.
Well, dishonest, I guess. Willfully dishonest, or...
No, we need a word that's even stronger than that. No, mind-fucking, okay? He's brain-raping. That's what he's doing. We just have to... Because, you know, everyone's saying, well, you got to back off from the lying claim. But I'm saying no, because what they're doing is even worse than lying. Because what they're doing is promoting, actively promoting... with good money behind them, with organizations that are publishing all kinds of propaganda to screw up the heads of children. And the English language is just deficient. We need something more powerful.
Well, I don't know. I think you summed it up just there. But
But we do need a separate word for... I mean, it's the fact that intentionally trying to sway somebody to your point of view in order to bolster your own faith.
Yes.
To make yourself feel like you are actually right after all. And if you get to that point, then it justifies whatever you do.
Yes.
And I think that's how they convince themselves that this behavior isn't terrible.
Right. And they're also doing this, you know, they're promoting these ideas that just make no sense, that even within their own worldview, that, for instance, this morning I wrote about this creationist, David Buckner in Canada, who wrote me this letter where he was crowing about, evolution is refuted. We've just shown it that it's wrong. And he cites a science paper that shows, you know, this nice fossil. And the thing is, it's so backwards, because this was a paper describing a 515 million year old fossil. David Buckma is a young Earth creationist. He thinks the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. So he can't use this as evidence that evolution is wrong, because the entire premise of the paper he regards as false. He doesn't believe that you can date things to be 515 million years old. So you see what I mean? That it's not just, he's wrong from the context of the science. He's also wrong from the context of his own personal weird beliefs. They just don't work.
It's just totally contradictory, isn't it?
Yes.
And to bring up the Bergman one just again, I mean, I believe my favorite part of the entire video was when somebody in the audience said, look, we've sat through, 40 minutes of you two putting forward evidence or talking about why we should be teaching ID in school. And they said, have you got evidence for intelligent design? And what came out of his mouth just stunned me when he said, basically what we need to do is we just need to prove that evolution's wrong. And I'm thinking,
yes.
If you think like that, if that is the logic that works behind the scenes for you, then I think you're unreachable, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
But that's surely a bad starting point for any sort of.
It's a terrible logical. Hang on. This is where you get to tell us, Trev. What's the name of the logical fallacy there?
Which one? I'm sorry. You knew I was going to space out at some point.
Oh, it was just then, was it? Oh, very sorry about that. No, I was talking about the question. It was basically, if we can prove evolution wrong, then obviously ID is true.
False dichotomy.
Yeah.
If one is wrong, the other must be true. Well, that's nonsense.
Thank you. See, this is why we have him, you know, because...
I have to poke him occasionally to, you know, wake him up. But
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so he's kind of handy to have there in the background. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let me say something else about that Bergman debate, because this was 2 years ago, and that was a debate that convinced me never again to debate creationists, that I was wasting my time, because this guy was such a flaming idiot. If you sat through the entire debate, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just bringing up this garbage nonstop throughout and never addressed the topic of the debate. But what prompted me to put that on the web recently is, as I mentioned, I've been pestered by this guy, Jonathan McClatchy, and I've been looking into his claims, and I just discovered something very strange about his claims, which was every time he had a claim where he cited a science paper, I'd look on the web and see who else was citing this, and I'd always find this whole body of creationists. In particular, one good indicator was Harun Yahya, who's the Turkish creationist. He's kind of a notorious plagiarist. He steals everything from everywhere, so I don't think he's the original source. But what it was telling me is, you know, that there's somebody out there who's promoting these weird interpretations of the scientific literature. And several of my commenters looked at it and they said, "Oh yeah, it looks like the guy is Bergman, because you can find this guy is nuts. He's obsessive and he just sits there writing these crazy crank creationist papers." And he publishes them in creationist journals all over the place. And then people pick them up and parrot them without thinking and using them in creationist debates. So Bergman, who's a flaming moron, who's recognizably delusional, is one of the primary sources of many of the arguments that creationists make nowadays.
The man's writing a trilogy of 5 books.
Yeah. Yes, he is.
But I just love the everything is irreducibly complex, even a carbon atom, which I thought was brilliant, because he seemed to take an idea which, you know, may have merit as an idea, which was obviously Behe's concept of pathways maybe being irreducibly complex. But when he extended it to everything, as you pointed out, it makes it completely worthless. And I don't think he didn't get that at all.
No, he didn't. You know, at the time of the debate, I also wrote this up on my blog, and I mentioned this business. Well, you know, he's citing Behe is defending his definition of irreducible complexity. And somebody wrote to Michael Behe and asked him, is this your definition of irreducible complexity? And Michael Behe wrote back and said, no, nothing like it. So, no, he's not only getting the science wrong, he's getting creationism wrong. He's got everything wrong.
I think even the underlying logic was demonstrably just wrong.
Yes. Throughout.
And I think it became very obvious, like within 2 minutes of him starting to speak, he was completely out of his depth, really.
Yes.
Yeah. What would you teach? What is the mechanism of intelligent design? And he had nothing for that, even though he accepted that change over time happens. Okay, well, how do you explain that?
Uh-huh.
He had no response.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm kind of interested what was on in those cards that you threw over your shoulder. I would have liked to hear that.
Oh.
It was the intellectual argument that you didn't need.
I came prepared with a whole bunch of notes on, for instance, various court cases in the United States that had tested whether you could, you know, teach creationism in the school. And I'd gone out and found many quotes from various other creationists about what kinds of things they would promote. And so I had all the facts sitting right there, and I was sort of thinking, well, he's going to say something relevant to this, and I'll be able to deploy this data to demolish him. And no, he never did. He never gave me an opening to present the data. It was just sad.
How very frustrating.
I think you looked positively bored by the end of it. I think you were waiting for the questions as well, weren't you? Because
yes, I was. No, I really, you know, even in his introduction, I realized all of a sudden this was a total waste of time, because he was never going to get to the point, and that he wasn't going to bring up anything cogent or interesting. And so, yeah, it was an excruciating time. The guy there who was moderating it is Mark Borello, who's a very smart historian of science who worked at the University of Minnesota, and I could see him just suffering horribly there, because he's a moderator. He couldn't charge in, but he kept Bergman kept bringing up these points of history that Borello knew forwards and backwards and knew everything about them and knew that he was totally dead wrong. And when he, for instance, brought up the Hitler argument, I thought poor Mark was going to explode. He was turning purple down there, and he had to just restrain himself so much.
Oh, yeah, that was the... there was no scientists. There was no scientists that were against the Nazis. And then it was like, yeah, apart from all those Jewish ones that upped and left.
Oh, my word. So I haven't had the pleasure of watching this yet. I will make time to watch it.
It's it's worth watching, like, but you know, only if you're a sucker for pain, I guess.
I am, because I do like to see these arguments where, you know, for instance, the Anne Widdecombe Chris Hitchens debate.
Oh yes.
I do kind of get a sick pleasure out of watching people, you know, die a death.
Yeah, it's
sorry, a bit macabre there, Steve, but okay.
Yeah, there are intellectual debates where you can sort of sit there and appreciate both sides, but sometimes you just want to hear a good beatdown. And yeah,
exactly.
Hitchens versus Widdecombe was that was a massacre. That was just a slaughter, and that was very entertaining.
Cool.
Anyway, have you got anything else, Trev? Well, you probably got loads.
Well, yeah. In fact, I've got one more Catholic story I'd like to do. I know two Catholic stories in 1 week is
well, I'm not playing.
Rules,
I'm but... not playing your jingle again, so just go for it.
Okay. I'm sure we all feel very restful from the last one. Basically, Pope tweets.
Oh yeah.
Pope Benny has tweeted, but he's going to start all of his tweets with "Dear friends," and end them all with "Praise be our Lord Jesus Christ." That only leaves him 93 characters in the middle to get any messages across. And I think he's added that stuff at the beginning and the end because apologizing for or renouncing inexcusable doctrines like contraception and homosexuality and physician-assisted suicide being sinful and the rape of children being forgivable, he can't do anything about it. Because it's only, that's right, 93. What am I going to do? See, I think Twitter was made to help him.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was made to help hers who don't want to listen to what he has to say, really, because, well, he's a bit of a prick, really, isn't he? Let's be honest.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really should follow him, shouldn't I?
Yeah, but I mean, if he was, what if he tweets you PZ like that guy did last night? I mean, you're just going to tell him to bugger off as well?
Well, yes, I would. I'd probably use stronger language with Pope, but you know,
you've got to use a language he understands.
I would love to get that screenshot on Twitter of the Pope saying, "Hey PZ, come and speak to me sometime," and then PZ saying, "Hey, bugger off, Ratzinger."
I can't see Ratzinger doing the sort of at PZ hashtag Nazis.
Yeah.
I don't see him putting together a sentence.
I don't either. No. He's going to be aloof, I'm sure, and yeah. It's not going to be a feed worth following. But oh well. Yeah. I also saw that he did this on an Apple iPad, and I wonder how much Apple paid for the product placement. That's got to be big money right there. It's got to be worth a lot to Apple. Yeah.
Like the hand of God touching the hand of
Adam. You're all so cynical.
And it's
you're
the hand of the Pope touching the iPad.
Yes, the iPad has now been blessed.
must have Catholic accessory.
And to be honest, I mean, if the priests are playing with iPads, it means it leaves them less time to play with other things. So, yeah. Are we going to talk about assisted dying?
I think that's quite.
If you've still got a little time to hang out with us, then,
sure. A few more minutes. Let's go.
Okay,
for
great.
It.
There was a debate on the BBC with what was it?
Terry Pratchett. Yeah.
Terry Pratchett. Yes, I saw that. Yeah.
That's fantastic. But it looks like it's going to be a discussion point in this country for a while. We're busting to get your take on physician-assisted suicide and the two states in America where it's actually allowed.
And which are they? Oregon's one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're pushing for it in Florida, aren't they? I believe the hemlocks
that's
are there.
Already God's graveyard anyway, isn't it, Florida?
Right.
Surely moving to Florida means you've already said you're tired of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm all for it. You know, I can't think of a single good argument against it. That you know, if people ought to have the choice. This is a very individual thing. This is something very personal, and people ought to have the right to decide when and how they want to end their life, especially when they're in circumstances that are so distressing. I'm sure it's very personal for Terry Pratchett with Alzheimer's disease. I know. If I were to be subject to Alzheimer's, I would stop existing when my brain went, and I would rather spare my family the indignity of maintaining the corpse in a semi-living state for so long. And I think physician-assisted suicide is the only decent, reasonable choice.
Oh, you let me down there, PZ. I thought you were going to go more for a kind of Logan's Run kind of solution.
Oh. Well, yeah, but in my case, it doesn't work because if I say all the people under 30 have to be off, you know, that's just because I'm certainly not going to say the over 30s. That's me.
That's a good point.
Well, you can just get some guy to do a grandfather clause for you, you know, and you'd be okay because you're, you know, old and you made the rules. So fine.
Yeah, but you see, it's only when people get over 30 that they become interesting.
He's got a good point there. I was really boring up until about a year ago.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, 4 years ago, you know.
Yeah.
Trev still is.
It's kind of a magical transformation, isn't it? Yeah.
That's right. I bored myself up until I hit 30.
Just can I just get a quick fire
question in?
Oh, I was going to say point of information. It's from Wikipedia, so it may not be right anyway. But apparently there's three states in the US which allow assisted suicide, which is Oregon, Washington, and Montana.
Oh, okay.
So that is from Wikipedia, but I'm not obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for euthanizing Hannah Montana.
Oh no, that's just mean.
Sorry, it's just I just remembered now that we still haven't managed to offend you or something, or at least your sensibilities. A quick question, PZ: yes or no? Should incest be decriminalized?
He keeps on bringing this up.
You want me just to say yes or no to that one? I would say yes. It should be decriminalized. The crime.
John's got a lot of love for his brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't the incest. The crime is involuntary sexual acts.
Of which there's obviously already laws against.
Yes, yes. So keep that criminalized. No, it should always be consensual. But no, I'm sorry. I just cannot work up outrage at somebody's personal preferences, even if there's something I would never do myself.
Oh, there you go. Anyone else got a quick question?
No, you sullied the water for me. I'm spent. Yeah. I can't go any further.
Well, you see, that's the great thing about that's why I am a good host, is I can wrap things up quite quickly.
Or just kill the conversation quite quickly, yeah.
Yes. That's the purpose of this incest question, just to kill the entire discussion right there. Okay,
that's it, it's gone dead, that's it.
I have to go take a shower now, excuse me.
Okay, well, just make sure the sister's not in there, yeah.
Oh, dear. Brain bleach.
Oh, John.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we knew it was going to happen towards the end. So, PZ, thank you so much for being on the podcast tonight. I hope it was at least slightly entertaining for you.
Oh, yes. Very entertaining. Let me know when it's up and I'll...
Yeah, it'll probably be up quite quickly. And I shall obviously tweet you and maybe you can do us a favor and retweet it, etc.
Yep. Very
great.
Good.
And I will now...
Thank you very much for me and I'm very sorry as well.
Yeah. Apologize for John, but thank you ever so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay.